Hi, and welcome to the Red Tunic Podcast, a podcast where I look to rediscover what makes gaming fun and enjoyable by having positive conversations with those related to the industry. My name is Link, and today I'm joined by Philip Tabatowski, co-founder and president of Young Horses, creators of Bugsnax and Octodad. Hi, Philip, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good, Link. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for asking. And Philip, I just want to say thank you so much for agreeing to come and talk with me. I really appreciate it, especially with, you know, you getting geared up and ramping up to come back to work and all of that fun stuff.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So, Philip, before we get started or before we get into it, if you don't mind, could you maybe tell me and my listeners a little bit about yourself? You know, who you are, what you do, all that fun stuff.
Yeah, sure. I'm Philip Tabatowski. I work at Young Horses Games. I'm CEO and president there. But what that actually means day to day is that I handle a lot of the business development and like communication with external companies and entities and YouTubers and Twitch streamers, etc. And I also, I have like a background in programming. My degree from DePaul University is in computer science. And I started out that way on the very first Octodad game we did, the student one. And then from there, I just kind of transitioned into all of this business stuff because someone needed to do it. and I just found it interesting, or the most interesting of the people that are on the team. I don't know. I've always wanted to make video games. It's been like the job that I've always wanted. And so I feel really lucky and kind of privileged to be able to be doing it and to continue doing it. Yeah, it's kind of like a little bit about me, I suppose.
Awesome. Well, thank you for sharing that. And, you know, there's a few things that I found interesting there. I'm trying to think of the best way to phrase it, but, you know, taking on the role that you took, kind of because, you know, and I don't know if I'm misunderstanding it, but I have a similar attitude for certain things where it's like, well, someone's got to do it. And, you know, and then ending up enjoying it and finding it interesting, I think it's just really neat. But yeah, you know, was when you went through for computer science, was that with the intention to be a, you know, to make games, or did you guys kind of just make the student version, I guess you would call it, of Octodad and, you know, go, oh, wow, this is, you know, this is a good use of our degree or what have you?
Yeah, it was always the intent to go into making games. I wasn't sure if it would be at a bigger studio or how that would work out over time. Initially, like before I even went to college, to university, my goal was to work at a place like Bungie or like a bigger studio like that, working on some, you know, huge game. And then kind of over time, when I learned a little bit more about independent developers and these smaller games that came out and how much kind of personality they can have and how much direct control each person on the team has over kind of what those games become, I became more interested in doing that and kind of went that direction. But while my degree is a computer science degree, it's also a like technically computer games development bachelor as well. And so we had a lot of like design classes and specific game creation courses throughout the program. Pretty much everybody on the team did.
You know, and that's really cool that that's, you know, what yours, what your program, I'm going to call it, you know, the schooling as a whole had, just because, you know, the original Octodad came out 2010-ish, I believe, yeah. If I'm not mistaken. And, you know, I graduated from from programming myself in about 2009, and we had very little of that. It was more of like a very generalized kind of shotgun approach where we had a little bit of everything, but that was one of the things that we had very little of. So it's interesting to hear that you all were afforded, I guess, the opportunity to have that kind of exposure to get like a better idea of that market, I guess, when when like the whole indie scene wasn't really at its peak yet, you know, because at 2010, right, as I'm sure you know, you know, I think Greenlight was just coming out, or it was maybe, you know, just sort of like getting ready. You know, the indie scene wasn't really that big yet. So the like you said, you know, the wanting to work at like a big studio, it was kind of that or bust in terms of what most people's approach would have been, if I'm not mistaken.
No, yeah, that's right. At the time, not many schools had that sort of program available. I think it was like DigiPen, at least in the US, DigiPen in Washington, and Full Sail maybe in Florida, and then DePaul. A few other places had smaller programs, but not ones where I had seen games come out of them of note, or ones where I had seen people actually then being likely to be placed in the industry or finding jobs in the industry, which is a very competitive job market. And so DePaul was one that attracted me just because of the kind of clubs they had. There's one called Defrag, which is a game development club there. And I had seen some of their like forums and stuff they had back when forums were more of a thing, and joined kind of because of that, because it seemed like there was a vibrant community of students there who were actively making games, not only for their classes, but outside of it as well. But yeah, it was, we were definitely lucky, and I feel like a lot of our success is built around the kind of context of the time that it happened. Like you were mentioning with Greenlight, I believe that was 2012 when that started, I want to say, because it was shortly after we started working on Octodad Deadliest Catch, which is the sequel to that, the commercial sequel to the student Octodad game, that we started working on because of the popularity of the free student game. And we actually were already in contact with Steam to be on Steam with Deadliest Catch by the time Greenlight was a thing, but we decided to go the Greenlight route anyways to kind of continue to test that. We had an amount of interest in players buying and playing Octodad Deadliest Catch that made it worthwhile to like continue developing and finish, which is something we did throughout the process, starting at the beginning when we raised roughly $24,000 with the Kickstarter campaign for the game back when it was just called Octodad 2. Kind of the whole time we were double checking, like, okay, we released this free thing. We know people liked and enjoyed that, but did they like and enjoy it just because it was free? You know what I mean? Would people actually pay money for this? And that's kind of why throughout development, we kept kind of double checking our sanity, so to speak, of, you know, is this a thing that's going to work out for us? Are we going to be able to make another game after this? And so we just kind of kept going, kept checking on the general popularity for it and the want to play it, I guess, through a lot of like external sources, like those things, which kind of helps keep your own ego or idea of like how good your game is in check and make sure that you like have realistic expectations, I guess.
So, you know, thank you for sharing that. Yeah, I understand what you're saying, because that makes sense, because the last thing you want to do, especially as, you know, especially when the indie scene is as young as it was then, the last thing you want to do is kind of jump all in without any kind of like buoy or what have you to let you know, right, you know, that you can stay above water, right? Just anything to help.
Some of the games that had come out almost immediately before we started on that student version of Octodad were, I think, Super Meat Boy. I don't remember if Monaco was out by then or not. I know Braid was. Some of those first Xbox Live Arcade games, which were some of the first self-published indie games to ever come out on consoles, just because Xbox Live Arcade became a thing. And up until that point, you know, you you're making a boxed version of the game. And then some of the games that kind of led me into deciding to pursue independent development were like Bit Trip Runner, Bit Trip Beat, that kind of series of games. I really enjoyed a lot because they're all like rhythm based, chiptune soundtracks, and stuff like that. And some of those other games I mentioned before, like Super Meat Boy and stuff like that. But those had all kind of just come out by the time we had released that first Student Octodad game. And those are some of the ones that made it like evident that this is maybe something we could do for real and form a company with. Because up until that point, there weren't many, at least not since like the early 90s, with a lot of like shareware, freeware games. That was like the last time I feel like this sort of thing felt possible by example. That's just kind of what led us down that path, or me personally, at least.
And, you know, thanks for sharing that. That's really, you know, that's really good that it did work out. And, you know, because I don't want to try and gloss over it too much and leading to the next question, but, you know, it is really good that it worked out. Because I remember when Octodad did first come out, the student version, or the, you know, the first one, I'll just say the first one. You know, I had a blast getting to play around with it. And I also had a blast getting to play around with the second one. I'm happy that it worked out for you guys, because I thought at the time that Octodad was just like, it was such a weird game. I don't mean that in a negative way.
It's definitely weird.
And like, you know, the second one just sort of amplified the weirdness with a much with like some more structure to it, I guess you would say. And like, you know, so yeah, I'm glad it worked out for you guys, because you know, I'm a huge fan of indie games, and you know, I just the especially the approach from indie teams where it's kind of like we're just gonna throw this weird idea at the wall and see if it works. And you know, I love it when those weird ideas work, because it, you know, it's just, it's refreshing. It's nice. It's always fun. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's always been interesting seeing the trade kind of back and forth between smaller games and bigger ones, because you see mechanics that are influenced from by one or the other in the other, I guess. Like, for instance, in Bugsnax, there's to track the Bugsnax, the creatures in the game, our system for like seeing their pathing in the 3D environment is kind of ripped directly from Horizon Forbidden, Horizon, the first one, and things like that. And then sometimes it goes the other way, where someone sees something in an indie game or a small game, and it makes its way into like being part of a larger system in like a AAA thing. And I enjoy that back and forth, kind of feeding creatively off of one another's ideas.
Yeah, definitely. I can understand that. And it's always, I imagine, like, if it's like a big compliment if you yeah, do a little thing and you see a big AAA game or what have you kind of riffing on it, like, you know, taking what they can from it and doing their own twist or what have you, just because, you know, for me personally, I would see that as like, oh, hey, you know, this big team really liked this idea as well that we did, and now they're showing what their take on it is, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely very flattering when that kind of thing happens, or at least I would be really excited by it.
Now, Philip, there is, you know, we probably covered this in different words or what have you, so I apologize if this is a kind of redundant question, but how did you get into developing making games, and from your experiences, is there any words of wisdom that you could share?
So initially, what had got me interested, I guess, in making games, I believe it was when I played The Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time on N64, on Nintendo 64. That was the first game. I'd been playing games since I was like 3 years old, but that game was the first time that I like looked through the credits as they rolled and wondered what each of those people did, like what a programmer was, because at the time I didn't know, and is what got me kind of initially interested in figuring it out. And then I think the first game that I actively tried to do anything development like with was a PC game called Black and White. It's kind of like a god game where you have like a little civilization of people that you're helping kind of form their own little colonies, and they worship you, and you have to decide if you're going to be kind of benevolent or not. And there are the creatures in those games. You could download mods and skins and stuff like that that people had made. And one of the first things I tried to do was, I think it was called like Milkshape 3D or something like that. There were some older programs where you could do some texture work and reskinning characters. And I tried to do that with some of the monsters in the game, the pets, the creatures, but never really got anywhere with it. Like I just kind of looked up different things on how to use it, and I tried to, and then eventually kind of just gave up, but I'd always kind of kept it in mind. And then when I was choosing like where I'm going to go for college, like game development was still the only job I had in mind that I felt like I would be happy doing. So I went to DePaul University in Chicago, and then kind of, you know, took all of, I guess what I liked about it is that it was still a 4-year university and still had all of the kind of general education stuff. And through doing a bunch of research and talking to people who had been in the industry, they suggested that as like kind of being someone who has a well-rounded education, well-rounded kind of knowledge base, being more valuable when you're looking for a job than if you had only gone to a technical school. And so that's kind of why I chose there. And for, you know, the first 2.5 or so years, I was just kind of taking my classes, making small games for those classes, taking my programming courses and all that. And then it was my sophomore year, like most of the way through it, almost junior year, that the class ahead of me had made a game called Devil's Tuning Fork. That was a first person game where you navigate via like echolocation with a tuning fork. And had kind of like an M.C. Escher style to it. And that game, they entered it into the Independent Games Festival at the Game Developers Conference. I think this was 2009. And they were nominated. So they were one of 8 games that were nominated, and they got to go to the award ceremony, and it seemed really cool, and they got some attention from publishers and things like that. And that didn't really pan out for that team, but the next year they were doing the same kind of program at DePaul, which is called the DePaul Game Experience, which is a, I don't know if you call it an incubator, but it was meant to simulate what it was like to work at a game development studio. And professors there who were the kind of mentors for the project interviewed a bunch of students who applied. You had to apply with your resume like you would for a job. And then they chose a team based on who they thought would work well with one another. And the whole goal was to create a small game and enter it into the student category of the IGF. And so that's kind of where Octodad was born out of. And, you know, that's a whole conversation in and of itself. I'm trying to decide where to kind of truncate and be concise. But yeah, after making Octodad, it became very popular and was played a lot. And that initial team was about 18 people, and 8 of us decided to move forward and try and make it like our full real jobs. Of course, that whole time during that making of that second Octodad, we each of us all still had our normal kind of day job, full-time jobs, and we were just working on it nights and weekends until it eventually came out and did well enough that we were able to leave those and do this full-time. But yeah, I don't know. That's kind of how I got into it, at least the short version, even though that's a little bit, it was a little bit long-winded.
So Well, I don't think it was that long-winded, so I wouldn't worry too much about that. But you know, that's really great to hear, because again, like the whole process that you went through is very interesting, because like you know, like you said, the kind of the incubator. I don't know if there's a more proper term or what have you. You know, incubator I think works just as well as it worked for you. But like that's really interesting that it was a whole process set up to stimulate the real worldness of it. And then, you know, I'm happy to hear that you guys found success with Octodad 2, that you were able to, you know, devote yourselves full time, just because you know, I think everyone can easily and empathetically relate to wanting to do a thing that you are happy with in life, something that you enjoy. So, you know, I'm happy to hear that you guys were as a team were able to do that. Now, from those experiences, is there like words of wisdoms or some do's or don'ts or what have you, or you know, in hindsight, things you would have maybe tried to do different that you could that you'd be okay with sharing?
Sure. I feel like this applies generally to everyone, whether with you're within the game development world or any other professional world, or I don't know, everyday life too, but taking advice from people with a grain of salt, I think is important. Just because no one person's experience and advice is applicable to all other people. There's a lot of situations in game development where a piece of advice may work well for one game and one team within one specific context and kind of time period, but it would not work at all for that same team's next game 2 years later, or another team's game. For instance, just like with Greenlight, us taking advantage of that only worked because we did it. We were part of Greenlight very close to when it first started. And as it went on over time, interest in it kind of waned, and like, I don't know, there was initially a marketing angle for it in that, excuse me, the press were writing about like most of the new Greenlight games that were being put on there to be voted on. And so you could get kind of coverage that way and attract people in to come and vote for your game, and then also just to know about your game at all. And over time, that wanes and it becomes less interesting and less people write articles about it. And so, like, obviously, now that doesn't even exist anymore. So, it definitely wouldn't be good advice. But as time goes on, some things become less relevant and they are less helpful, depending on like what you're making and what team you're on and when it's happening. And there, I've seen times where a younger group of developers take advice from more seasoned developers, and it just doesn't work out for them because it doesn't make sense for kind of what they're doing and when they're doing it. And so I usually try to kind of give the advice of trying to get advice from multiple outside sources, vetting them against one another, and then coming to your own kind of educated decision, which sounds very reasonable and maybe obvious, but I feel like when you're younger and you get advice from someone who is experienced, it's easy to think that, like, well, they must have the right answer and it must definitively be the right answer for me. And that's not always the case. And it's often not the case in my experience. And you need a certain amount of practiced kind of self-awareness to know that, and to only act on things that actually make sense for you and your game and your team. And I think that's probably true for other professions as well, where you may get advice from a professor or something who did work in the industry you're trying to go into, but it was 10 years ago, and those are no longer like the standards that you need to meet, or the technology that anyone's using, or whatever. Things change, and so you kind of always have to be up on those changes and aware of what makes sense for you. So I guess, yeah, my advice would be to be wary of advice and to kind of critically think about it when someone gives it to you and consider what their context was for giving it to you and when they may have kind of used that same information to their benefit. Because you, I don't know, different people have different motives, I guess, not to be sinister or anything, but people's experiences color the kind of advice they give.
So yeah, you know, I understand what you're saying completely, and I agree completely. And it's weird because, you know, that's not something that I would ever think to advise on, like to point someone in that direction. However, it makes perfect sense. And, you know, I've been programming, you know, in my current role for like 6 years now. I graduated in like 2009. You know, what I'm getting at is I have, you know, I don't want to say a great library of experience, but I have some experience. And, you know, to comment kind of directly or more at the statement of, you know, younger people when they're starting out might not know to think like that. However, I wouldn't have thought like that. So it's I think that's good advice regardless of your experience level, just because sometimes it's really easy, you know, the more experienced you get, to kind of tunnel vision yourself. And right. When you're starting out, like you said, if you have someone that you know, you look up to, or you see them as experienced or what have you, you know, you have such a wide view that them saying the one thing, regardless of the validity of it, you know, because like you said, sometimes there are different motives, or like your own experiences have colored how you will advise or direct people. Not to say like, you know, it's sinister in nature, but right. You know, the when you have such a wide view, it's going to get very, very thin the moment you have someone trusted telling you something. Whereas, you know, as you get more experience, that view will grow a little, but that's just good advice all around, I think. Sorry for, to ramble on that one, but I think that's just good advice all around. So thank you for that. For, you know, the people that are new and old. That's sounds like very solid advice.
Yeah. I think it's easy to give bad advice and difficult to give good advice, basically.
You know, yes, I understand that as well completely. It's always one of those things where you kind of have to try and temper it. And in my case, whenever I give direction or advice, always just say, if my fingers crossed, going, please don't come back and bite me. Please don't come back and bite me.
Yeah, pretty much the same here.
So, Philip, you mentioned that Ocarina of Time was kind of the game that started your interest in getting into the industry or making games. Was there something specific about it that made you play this game and go, oh, this is what I want to do? Or was it like the goal game as a whole that made you just go, this is a thing that I can do?
I think it was the game as a whole, although I guess maybe at the time what you would call open world nature of it was like especially impressive to me. It was something I feel like I had never played or experienced before. I played a lot of games, but not enough, and not enough like PC games to know that things like that had not exactly been done that way before, but been done in one form or another. And so that was just the first one that I experienced that I was kind of amazed by how fleshed out the world was and how things felt, at least at the time, they felt pretty alive and connected. There were a lot of things in that world where you would go to one area and they knew about a character far away in another, and maybe they mentioned them initially, and then later on you find out there's some side quest or something like that that leads you from one side of the map to a completely different side. I don't know, it was just very interesting to me at the time. What was that, like 96 or 7, I think, which means I would have been 9 or 10, I want to say. And so I think it just hit at exactly the right time in my life when I had enough free time to just sit with it. And yeah, I had been, you know, reading Nintendo Power and EGM and magazines like that my whole life, basically. And they often had, you know, interviews and stuff alongside reviews and previews. And I just think I found what developers had to say always really interesting. And it sounded like something I'd want to do. And then a younger version of me also was like, I don't want to go to an office and wear a suit and, like, you know, that sort of be like a business person, even though I technically am now a business person. But and so video games sounded nice because I also knew, like, oh, a lot of game developers seem to just like wear jeans and t-shirts to the office. And that's what I always saw in pictures or in, like, I remember the Halo 2 like bonus DVD that had the making, had like a making of documentary on it and showed their office. And I was like, these guys, these people, these developers, they just look like some of my friends or something. That looks nice. As opposed to, like, I don't know, working for some boss doing TPS reports or whatever. So yeah, I think that's kind of what drew me to it initially, from starting with Ocarina of Time and then kind of becoming even more interested with things like Halo, and those kinds of like documentaries and press coverage where they talked more about the making of things. And I have always had like a pretty big interest in the making of anything creative. Like, I always used to watch those like behind the music things on VH1, and I don't know why, I just like enjoy hearing about creative people talk about their work and their processes. And I think that kind of led me to being one.
So thank you for sharing that. And, you know, that's, I can definitely relate to a lot of what you just said. Especially the whole not wanting to be that person wearing like a suit and tie, having to go in and do like TPS reports and have to sit with like the coworker that just says nonsense, like somebody has a case of the Mondays or what have you. Right. Yeah. So yeah, I can definitely understand the appeal on that side of things. Also, I just want to note, because I looked quick, because I didn't remember how old Ocarina of Time was, and that came out in 98, and I feel much older than I did beforehand. I thought that was I thought that was like closer to the 2000, or maybe just after, but yeah, so thank you. I now feel a little bit older than I already did.
You're very welcome.
But no, thank you for sharing that, because that's, you know, it's interesting hearing the motivation and hearing like the hearing other people's creative process inspiring you to also want to kind of follow in that direction. And like, I think that's also kind of an important thing to keep in mind, that when you're searching for like what you want to do or who you want to be or what have you, the idea of getting as much exposure to a lot of different things, you know, regardless of how weird some of it can be. And weird's a very, the wrong word to use here. But like how unorthodox it might be, so to say, because, you know, like the VH1 Behind the Music, I believe that was typically about like the downfall of bands.
Yes, usually.
So that would be the unorthodox, in watching someone's demise, a group's demise, and going, this is what I want to do.
Yeah. I think it's more just finding it fascinating and wanting to be in any world even adjacent to that. I don't know. It's I just like glommed onto anything where it was like, this is how this was created.
Yeah. And, you know, like I said, like I think I can understand that. And, you know, as I've gotten older, you know, looking back, I realized, oh, that there were things I could have or should have done to like open myself up more. And, you know, I think it's just something that more people should do, just because you are ultimately like, you're not really aware of it until you start getting exposed to things and go, oh, wow, like, where was this when I was like 8? Where was this when I was like 10? This would have fundamentally changed, you know, a lot about, you know, who you are, right? So
right,
that's interesting to hear. So because of that, I'm you mentioned a few different games there and a few different games that led you down this path. I'm wondering, were any of those games, like, would they be your favorite games, or does your favorite game maybe come before the games that inspired you and made you look more into, you know, how the sausage is made or what have you?
Favorite game in general of all time? Yeah, I mean, it's probably, like, they're pretty, I don't know, basic answers, I guess, or common answers, but Ocarina of Time and Halo Combat Evolved, the first Halo, those two are probably the ones that I've spent, well, up until more recently with Destiny. Those two games were the most time I've spent playing anything overall. I've probably beat that first Halo game 26, 27 times. A lot of that time, you know, playing co-op Legendary with friends and things like that, or Ocarina of Time. I know I ran through it a ton of times. I had the Prima strategy guide, like, after banging my head against it for so long, I was like, okay, I just want to know, like, all the secrets about everything and run through with that, and, like, kind of 100% it. I played that a ton of times. Those are both big favorites of mine, for a long time. I mean, I still like them a lot, but I've just played more as time has gone on, obviously. And then currently, Destiny 2 is probably my favorite game. It's definitely the one I spend the most time with. It's definitely my, like, comfort hobby game that I go back to time and time again, just to kind of enjoy the storytelling and the live the game as a service kind of nature of it, where it's always changing and evolving, and there's always something new to do. And then it has the kind of, like, Bungie first person shooter secret sauce that I feel like only they have, where the moment to moment gameplay in their games feels better to me than pretty much anybody else's. At least when it comes to first person shooters, they have something special going on there that it's very kinetic and hard to describe, and pretty incredible, because, I mean, different people like or don't like the wrapping and the other systems and how complex Destiny can be, but, like, I feel like you cannot deny how good it feels moment to moment just to shoot the guns, jump around, slide, run, and things like that. It's unlike anything else, in my opinion.
So, you know, far be it for me to comment on that, because I actually have never played Destiny 1 or Destiny 2. So I can't really speak to that directly, but from what you were describing, you know, I'm familiar with those mechanics, and I can relate to enjoying those kind of mechanics in other games, just because, like, the frenetic or kinetic nature of being able to do those things, you know, sometimes regardless of how they're implemented, is always fun in my, like, for me, they're always fun, just because it's one of those things where it doesn't feel stagnant, right? So, you know, I can definitely, like I said, I can't speak to what you said exactly, but I can understand how and why that would be an enjoyable thing, especially, like you said, if it's from Bungie. You know, they were known for doing, you know, solid gameplay. So, like, having a group that has previously shown they can deliver, I can easily guess that it's probably a polished experience that would easily be, you know, enjoyable, right?
Yeah, I think it's, for me, like, it may just be a personal preference thing, but I've attempted to go and play other first-person shooter games like Overwatch or Counter-Strike, and none of them ever felt right to me, I guess, compared to something like Destiny or Halo, where I was just like, this is, like, ideal. Like, I love how this feels to play. And so I think that just contributes a lot to it outside of even all the world building and the storytelling and all the other things. Yeah.
And, you know, I can definitely understand that as well. Cause I had like some of my older friends, they were really into, like playing Destiny 1 and 2 when it came out.
Mm-hmm.
And, they were very much against playing some of the other arcadey games like Counter-Strike Source or what have you, because like it wasn't the same. Like, well, both of them were kind of arcadey. Well, both of them were kind of like in the same realm of existence, so to say. They were like the minute-to-minute gameplay or the gunplay feel or what have you just was never up to snuff for what they were expecting. So I can definitely understand, you know, that angle from things. Cause I'm, you know, I imagine that's the case for a lot of people where, you know, they expect X, from their experience. They, like, you know, they're used to X, Y, and Z, and then they get something and it delivers an entirely different set of core gameplay. Right.
Yeah. I guess I have a difficult time holding like a game. When I play a game, it has a difficult time holding my attention if it does not have that like excellent game feel to it when you're playing, no matter how good the kind of rest of it is. I feel like that's why I never got into, I don't know, like a turn-based RPG, like a Final Fantasy, the non-action ones, because it's just moment to moment. When you're just kind of choosing menu options, I'm like, this isn't grabbing me, even though I know it is good. And I know, you know, plenty of people absolutely love those games. For me, I like need something to hold my attention, I guess. And being able to like run and jump around and have that feel good is important for that for me. Otherwise I get distracted and want to do something else.
So there's something you said there. And like, I've never actually kind of followed up on that. And before we move on, I do want to kind of touch on it. Not really, you know, there isn't a whole lot to explore with it, but like, you know, as so, you know, cause you're similar age to me from what it sounds like. I'm 35. You know, you graduated, you graduated around the same time I did. So I think it's safe to infer we're very similar in age.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm 34.
Now, for me, I don't know what your take is on this, but for me, I think it's just wild that, you know, when I started playing games, the concept of game feel just wasn't a thing. There's other talks. There's, you know, bigger talks have happened about this. I've just never mentioned it or tried to, like, dive into it myself. But I found it weird, or not weird, I find it fascinating that, like, game feel is now a topic that is focused on, that is like quantifiable, mm-hmm. that like developers are actively chasing, because like we have so many examples of good game feel. But yeah, you mentioning it made me think like I think it's a great time for games now that, you know, like as we have more quantifiable things to help people determine what it is makes a game good and enjoyable to them, not mm-hmm. to try and like dismiss, you know, game feel from, like you said, from an RPG versus a, you know, Destiny or what have you. But, you know, I just want to say, I think it's fantastic that we are finding ways to describe and create metrics that help, that ultimately help everyone find games that they can enjoy more. Right. Does that make sense what I'm trying to say, I guess?
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think it's true, and it's largely because it's game development, both per game and then with development overall, going, you know, making one game and then making another, so iterative, and so it's just something that will continue to improve and kind of diversify over time, because, you know, different game feel kind of characteristics or types attract different types of players and people who enjoy different things. Like the obvious, I feel like, example is like the Demon's Souls or Dark Souls games. They have a very specific, or like Bloodborne, very specific game feel to them, where it's generally pretty slow compared to other action games, but very intentional. And it's about knowing the timing of a lot of things, and being patient, and knowing patterns and stuff like that, which are all true for for a lot of games, but for this one, for those games, there it's a very specific kind of it, kind of game feel. And either you enjoy that sort of thing, or you probably don't, or you have to kind of learn to enjoy it. I feel like it takes some, the on-ramp there is longer than it is for other games that are more forgiving and transparent, I guess. Whereas that those games are kind of opaque in a way on purpose as part of the design. And that kind of thing and those kinds of experiments are just really interesting to me, because there's a whole kind of gamut of possibilities between something that's very accessible and easy to pick up and know what you're doing, and then something where the whole game is understanding how to play the game. And it's nice that there's room for both of those things and everything in between.
Exactly. I could not, you know, I couldn't have said it better myself, and I agree completely. So, Philip, I don't want to take up too much more of your time. I want to, you know, let you get on with your day. I want to let you, you know, do what needs to get done. However, before I do let you go, I'm wondering if you have time to let me bother you with maybe one more question.
Sure.
Awesome. So, Philip, outside of games, what is it you do? What do you do to enjoy, or what do you do to relax? What kind of hobbies do you have? And I understand that this is kind of a loaded question in that the answer could easily just be games. However, that is a valid answer to that question. But at the same time, you know, I like to ask it because, you know, I feel that, you know, we might not always have the full understanding of game developers, and that they are people that have, you know, their own things that they enjoy, and they're not just games, you know?
Yeah, I enjoy music a lot. And before the pandemic, I used to go to concerts quite often. And I collect records. And so I have like, I don't know, 320 or so vinyls. And like a nice, like listening setup. And I enjoy that. I build Legos pretty often. That's a terrible, expensive hobby where I have now have so many sets that even though I have a house now, I don't have places to put them all. And I've started like breaking them down and donating the pieces to charity and stuff like that, where they use them in children's hospitals and stuff, just because I don't have room for the new sets that I'm getting. I enjoy that. And then, yeah, I mean, I became a dad back in July of last year. And so just been spending a lot of time with my son and enjoying that a lot. Feels like it's something I was like always meant to do or something like that. I don't know. I enjoy that a lot. Just hanging out with him.
So first off, you know, congratulations on becoming a father. I don't really know the other things surrounding that, you know, that usually are said. I'm being 35, I don't have kids yet myself, and I don't really hang out with people that do. So, I apologize that there isn't more to say that on my side, congratulations. It's great to hear that is fulfilling for you. You know, cause it, you know, it's good when things bring you joy, right? I'm going to get off that because there's probably other stupid things I can say that would just not be down the right path accidentally. So congratulations. I'm happy for you. That is, you know, going so well.
Appreciate it.
Now, you know, it's amusing to hear about the Legos, and I, you know, for two reasons. One that I think is very, is very admirable. I think that's the word. Of you to the way you're donating them when you built them and you don't have room or what have you. I think a lot of the causes that are based around like children's hospitals and such, mm-hmm. I think they're always fantastic. And I think they're always things that, you know, that deserve, more attention, because like, you know, for anyone that doesn't know, Usually, like those kind of setups are not, you know, when usually our kids are in the hospital for a while, it's never a good time, right? It's never a good thing. So, you know, I think that's just really admirable of you to donate, you know, donate your what have yous for to I imagine help out in way more ways than people are probably aware of. However, not to dismiss that, not to lean you away from it, but as someone that builds like model kits myself, this is a weird segue, so I apologize. It's not meant to, again, dismiss or diminish. However, I'm kind of at that point of like, I don't have any place to put them, but I live in an apartment, so I don't really have places. But my main goal is when I have a place is using those book ledges effectively, and putting them all like running around the ceiling and putting things up there. I don't know how well that would work for you, but that's usually when I hear other people in the model community talking about having no room. It's like, well, use your vertical space. Like, you know, you're not using that last foot on the ceiling. Just go for it. Like to the ceiling, just go for it. Right.
Yeah, I started hanging some vertical or some floating shelves, and I have used the ones up that I have already, but I'm concerned about going around the whole room or whatever, because then I feel like maybe I'm like surrounded or something. But I think I enjoy the meditative process of building them more than I do displaying or like having them afterwards. It's more just like enjoying the quiet time of reading the instructions and putting it all together, seeing the final result. And then I'm like, okay, well, that was enough for me. And like, I can move on to the next one.
And, you know, I completely understand that as well. Like, you know, as I said, I build models. So yeah, I can definitely relate to that. And that just makes as much sense to, you know, cause there's a lot of people in the community as well that are like, well, I just want to build it. I like the, like you said, the meditative nature of it. And then, you know, they just get rid of stuff after. So I understand that completely. Now I am curious, when it comes to like, cause there's so much Lego, and there's always new stuff coming out and all of that. Is there a Lego kit set, what have you, that's coming out or that you haven't had your chance, got your hands on, that you are sitting there going, oh, that's going to be something you enjoy, that you really want to do or build or what have you?
There definitely are, but I'm attempting to not buy more because I currently have a like large lighthouse set, a Bowser like Mario set, a set from The Office, the TV show, like all just like sitting waiting to be built that I bought before my son was born, and haven't even had time to start those yet, but I'm still often tempted. The Rivendell Lord of the Rings set that recently came out looks extremely cool, but is also enormous and expensive. But that's been tempting. It's probably the one that I'm most excited about right now. There are also some smaller Indiana Jones sets that I'm into and might pick up. But it's difficult to stop once you start. I feel like, I don't know, I'm like, all right, I haven't bought any new sets for a while now, but if I start, I will just continue to buy sets, which is, you know, it's a fun problem to have.
So again, I can relate to that. I understand completely what you're saying. So I guess the only thing I can say to that is I wish you the best of luck in your endeavors moving forward.
Thank you.
I understand it is a hard problem to get around or what have you, you know?
Yeah, it's really hard for me. Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, like you said, your son's a little young now, I imagine. However, you know, it's only going to be a handful of years until you have a wonderful excuse to start picking up more. So that way it can be a father-son project, right?
Exactly. Of course. I have definitely been thinking about that when he gets a little bit older.
Well, I wish you the best of luck in that path as well.
Thank you.
So, Philip, as I said, I don't want to take up too much more of your time. I do want to let you get on with your day, get to, you know, get back to your life. with your, you know, your young child and games and, you know, work and all of that fun stuff. However, if there was anything else you want to discuss, you know, a cool game, what you're working on, something you feel more people should just be aware of, by all means, the floor is yours, as well as please let everyone know where they can find more information about you, which I'll also include in the episode description.
Sure. Quickly, I guess I'm playing the Resident Evil 4 remake right now, which is incredible. Enjoying that a lot. Really enjoyed the original one when it came out. As far as a game, I don't have anything to promote myself, I guess. If you haven't played Bugsnax or Octodad Dadliest Catch, both of those are available on pretty much every platform where you can buy video games. You can follow me on Twitter at PTibz, P-T-I-B-Z. I'll follow at your own potential peril there. I just kind of... I mean, sometimes I'm tweeting about game development stuff, but often it's just about everything. And I would highly recommend, if people have not played it, they pick up the game Tunic. It's a Zelda, like kind of old school style game, but it's beautiful and is a really interesting world filled with like a ton of secrets. And I found that game like particularly enjoyable in the last year. It's like one of my new favorite games of all time.
Well, thank you for those recommendations, as well as I will make sure that, you know, people can follow you at their own peril if they so much as choose.
I just tweet often, that's all, I guess.
As well, you know, I'm happy to hear that you're having fun of Resident Evil 4. You know, as anyone that has played it previously, like myself, I really enjoyed it, and you know, it was a fantastic game, and I I'm looking forward to eventually having the time to get to it. So it's good to hear that it's, you know, I've only heard good things. So it's good to hear from one more person that it's good, as well. You know, Tunic, I can't agree more. Fantastic game from what I've played. My only complaint with Tunic is you have to be in the mood for it. You have to be in the right mindset to understand the large minutiae of not having an idea of what's going on most of the time.
It's a game that took me a while to get into. I didn't immediately click with me, but after, like, it's easy to play but not as easy to understand exactly what you should be doing outside of exploring. But once you start to kind of pick up the language of the game as it puts it out there in more ways than one, it kind of opens up and is pretty incredible.
Yes, I agree completely with what you just said, is that it's a very, you know, anyone that's enjoyed a Zelda game or has enjoyed a Zelda-like game or what have you, they're going to enjoy Tunic. Yes. But like you said, until you start to pick up what it's putting down, it is almost disorienting or fever dream-ish in the sense of not understanding what's going on.
Yeah.
But like I said, Philip, I don't want to take, you know, keep you too much longer. So if there wasn't anything else, I will let you get back to your day.
No, I think that's it. Thanks again for having me.
No, Philip, again, thank you so much. You know, the pleasure was all mine, and I'm happy that you were able to make time, you know, take time away from everything to speak with me.
Yeah, of course.
So thanks again to Philip for making time to have this conversation with me, and thank you for joining us on the Red Tunic podcast, as well as a special thanks to Ron Jenkins for the use of music from the title track from Road Steep. And if you like this podcast and want to support it and help it grow, please subscribe or follow me on Twitter at Red Tunic Podcast to receive the latest episodes and news, and be sure to share it with those you think might also enjoy it. Thanks, till next time.